Maritime Matters, global perspectives through a German lens for the maritime industry. We bring the German perspective to the world and global insights to Germany. Maritime Matters is produced by the German Maritime Center, the think tank for the German maritime sector.
Welcome to our podcast. My name is Matthias Katon. I'm the managing director of the German Maritime Center and your host. My guest today is Vidar Helgesen, the executive secretary of the Intergovernmental Oceanographic Commission at UNESCO. Before his current position, he served from 2021 to 2024 as the executive director of the Nobel Foundation. And previously, he held several senior roles in the Norwegian government, including Special Representative for the Ocean, Minister of Climate and Environment, Minister of European Affairs, and Chief of Staff to the Prime Minister. And he was also at some point the Secretary General of International IDEA, an intergovernmental organization that supports democracy worldwide. And I'm mentioning that because that was the place where we first met in 2006 when Vidar was the Secretary General and I was a program officer. After not having seen each other for, I would say, about 15 years or so, we recently bumped into each other at the UN Oceans Conference in Nice on board the truly wonderful Norwegian bard Statsraad Lehmkuhl. And that was great seeing you. You haven't changed a bit. So it was wonderful seeing you. And now, obviously, to talk a little bit more about the work that you do at the IOC. Thank you very much for being available for this podcast, Vidar.
Thank you for having me, Matthias. And indeed, it was great to see you. One of the great things about the ocean that we normally say about the ocean is it connects people. But I was truly surprised to suddenly be reconnected with you in a totally different domain than when we first met. That was
absolutely great. Yeah. But they told me, I'm not sure if you would echo that, is once you're in that domain, the maritime business, the oceans, you never leave. So that's what several people actually told me.
Yeah, you can take a man out of the ocean, but you can't take the ocean out of a man.
Excellent. So you lead UNESCO's Intergovernmental Oceanographic Commission, which, among other things, coordinates the UN Ocean Decade, which we're currently in, more or less halfway. So that's one of the things that we will talk about today. But maybe first of all, in simple terms, what is the job of the commission? What are you doing there? Why is it part of UNESCO?
It is the UN body for ocean science and ocean observation and ocean data, and based on that also support for countries in ocean policy and ocean management. Why at UNESCO? It came out of a science process, and that's how it landed there. But we're a body with autonomy, so we have our own member states, our own governing bodies, and relate a lot to different UN agencies that also have ocean mandates, be that the IMO or the FAO or other bodies with ocean engagement. Our role is to coordinate the Global Ocean Observing System, to coordinate research into everything we still don't know about the ocean. So we're really at the hub of member states that are committed to knowing more about the ocean and acting better for the ocean.
I mentioned it, we're in the middle of the UN Ocean Decade, one of the things that you are coordinating. There was a conference, I believe, in spring of 2024 in Barcelona to commemorate or celebrate the midpoint, more or less. Can you walk us a little bit through where we stand, how maybe priorities have also changed for the second half of that decade?
Yeah, the background for the decade, to start there, was obviously SDG, Sustainable Development Goal 14, and the need to mobilize more knowledge about the ocean. The ocean is, as we all know, 70% of the planet's surface, but it's 95% of the biosphere. It's 95% of our life support system. And still, less than 20% of it has been explored. And given the importance of the ocean for so many parts of human life and economic life, we need more knowledge. And that's the background for the decade. It's a decade of ocean science, but for sustainable development. So it's not only a matter for scientists. So we're engaging governments, engaging philanthropies, civil society in what is indeed the biggest mobilization we've seen for the ocean and for ocean knowledge. Halfway, We've seen a lot of activities, more than 600 global projects, more than 60 global programs, financed by approximately $1.5 billion US dollars. So it's a fairly big mobilization. But when we look forward based on that bottom-up mobilization, we're now looking at focusing on which areas are critical, the most critically deficient in our knowledge about the ocean towards 2030, when the decade will end, and what should we bring onwards. Clearly, the deep ocean is one of those areas where we need to focus more. We need more effort. There are many mysteries in the deep ocean, both in terms of biodiversity, in terms of minerals. It's essential in terms of ocean observing infrastructure. We're also seeing initial signs of climate change hitting and impacting also in the deep ocean, but we don't really know the dynamics. So there's a lot to do there. And then, of course, we have a big issue like biodiversity, particularly with the new global biodiversity framework and the agreement on biodiversity beyond national jurisdiction, as an area where we need more knowledge essentially to serve agreements that are coming into place. We still lack a lot of understanding when it comes to the global carbon cycle, which is essential for climate action, to really understand the role of the ocean and the opportunities and the limitations of the ocean in terms of mitigation and adaptation. So still a range of issues that we really need to learn more about, and we are seeking to mobilize action essentially to serve international agreements and to serve national ocean planning. So those are priorities going forward.
More than 600 initiatives or projects that are part of that. That's an enormous amount or enormous number. It's probably even for someone who works on those things daily, it's difficult to keep track of all those things permanently. And maybe it's also difficult to pick and choose some. But can you give us some examples of projects that you think have been primarily successful or promising, to give our listeners some ideas of what is underneath this enormous number of things going on?
There's a lot happening in the biodiversity space, partly because that's an area where there is more attention and where you have these international agreements coming. So our estimate is that globally we've identified between 15 and 30% of species in the ocean. It's a fairly big span simply because there's so much we don't know. But we have some really exciting programs and projects on exploring ocean biodiversity. And I'm highlighting that because it's important for putting to use, as the world has actually agreed on important frameworks for managing biodiversity better. And businesses as well are coming to realize the importance of the ocean for biodiversity, not only for food, but for materials, for nutrition in other forms than food. So it's quite an exciting domain. Another very important area, which is really foundational, is mapping the global seafloor. We are, when the decade set out, I think we were at 17% of ocean seafloor being mapped. Now we're at 27%. So it's not fast progress, but it's significant. And that's really foundational for understanding the ocean. And then we have some new initiatives that are really playing to that mystery of the ocean. I can mention, since minerals and the quest for ocean minerals is an important debate these days, there was a discovery last year that nodules, mineral nodules on the bottom of the Pacific were surrounded by surprising amounts of oxygen, suggesting that these essentially very hard golf ball-like structures actually play a role in producing oxygen. And a new Ocean Decade project is now setting out to understand what's actually happening.
17% to 27% of the seabed explored. That's still a little, I mean, it's a quarter, a bit more than a quarter. It's fascinating how little we actually know. Did you mention that as well? Now, we at the German Maritime Center, obviously, we look at the ocean from the business perspective. That's our mandate. And when we were in Nice, I was also very positively surprised, maybe, that in almost every discussion, there was talk about the blue economy. So this need to balance, on the one side, the protection issue, protecting biodiversity, protecting the oceans, with a recognition that, of course, we need the oceans also as an economic entity. And that has lots of facets, from, you mentioned that, nutrition to a mode of transportation to exploitation of raw material and so on and so forth. So the question is, you know, how do we balance these two vital needs? And therefore, my question, when we talk about the UN Ocean Decade, what is a role for business there? Is there something where you think companies that work on or with the oceans should become directly involved? Or is it something where you say, well, you know, we actually try to move them away as far as possible?
It's certainly the former. We want more business engagement. It's probably the area where we've seen the least traction, but we do have some. And one of the very important contributions that ocean industries can make is sharing data. Ocean industries possess a lot of data. Understandably, some of it might be commercially or security-wise sensitive and therefore not for sharing. But even so, you can reduce granularity and still share some information or metadata. But there's also a lot of data simply stacked away and not shared for reasons of habit or unawareness. And we have a corporate data group under the Ocean Decade, which is now intensifying efforts to mobilize more data from the private sector. And this is critical for what you started with, which is how do we balance? How do we ensure that we can harvest from the ocean, have a thriving, sustainable ocean economy that is sustainable in the sense that it's not taking more out of the ocean than the ocean can regenerate? And for that, we need ocean planning, and that planning needs to be knowledge-based. And that's the huge dilemma when there's so much we still don't know. And there are obviously potential conflicts, but with knowledge and data, we can navigate those conflicts better. So we would really encourage more ocean industries to come forward.
Is that also something that could directly benefit the maritime industry in the sense of better forecasts, for example? So if we have more data, we will be able to foresee weather incidents, for example, or similar things better than we can today. So things that have a direct positive impact on the operations, for example, of a shipping company?
Absolutely. And here you're handing me an opportunity on a silver platter, because we're running the Global Ocean Observing System. And so we're not only gathering existing data, but we're generating new data. Member states are investing in the infrastructure, but we're coordinating and making the data available. And the Global Ocean Observing System is critical also for shipping, because all weather starts in the ocean. That means all extreme weather starts in the ocean. And we're seeing more extreme weather coming and more suddenly, clearly impacting shipping and impacting ports. So there's more infrastructure damage and more risks for maritime safety to be expected. And we can mitigate that by better real-time ocean observing. And we've actually, one of the things we did at the UN Ocean Conference in Nice was to launch an initiative called 10,000 Ships, where we invite commercial ships to take part in ocean observing. Most ships have weather stations, but if, say, 10% of ships also could have ocean observing boxes that could take water samples, that would add to a lot of things, but it would also add to maritime safety. Plus, better ocean prediction will also help shipping companies choose the most fuel-efficient routes. So there's a lot to be had for self-interest by engaging in this, but also, of course, the common interest.
I think we're at a point in history where there is one thing that will facilitate what you're trying to do, data exchange, better data analysis, and that is obviously advances in IT, not least with artificial intelligence and ever more potent capabilities of analyzing data, especially also unstructured data or data that is not compatible, which in the old days was, I believe, often the major hurdle, is that you had, you know, data that was categorized in a different way, and then you had to spend a lot of time to make it comparable. Now you have methods that are increasingly better and better, where you just dump all the stuff in and then you have an AI system basically sort things out. I'm making things too easy sound too easy, but I mean, that's at least a process, right? So that will help, I would assume, correct?
It will certainly help in aiding prediction and modeling and practical solutions for whether it's government planning, whether it's business planning or implementation of multilateral treaties, where that's also the digital twin of the ocean, which is an exciting project, AI accelerating the speed of applications, really, and the precision of applications, really, really promising. But where it will not help is on getting the data. So I'm back again to the fact that there's so much we don't know. So if you don't have the data flow, there are limitations to what those beautiful applications can deliver. I'm often likening it to a beautiful fountain,
Yeah.
People are quite fascinated if they see a beautiful fountain. They don't care too much about the plumbing. But if you don't have good plumbing, if you don't have the water supply, eventually that nice fountain will not be so pretty. So we need to make sure that we improve on the data flow, and that will really deliver good results.
Yeah. And that actually leads me to the other point that I would like to get your insights or your assessment on. Given the situation that we live in globally, geopolitically, and we're both based in Europe, we're Europeans. So obviously, you know that there's hardly a day or hardly an event that you can attend nowadays where the discussion not touches upon security and defense issues after about 5 minutes at most, I would say. So we live in an age where geopolitical tensions are rising. I think that's a fair assessment. And I've actually attended also events where people from the security or the defense community criticized the basic scientific approach of sharing data. So data and scientists have always traditionally been operating on the assumption, you know, we share data, we collaborate internationally, we try to advance the common objective of, you know, getting a better understanding of, say, the oceans. Now, if you bring in the security community, they will very soon tell you, well, this is not so easy and we should not do that. You know, there's obviously with almost every data, there can also be military use. You mentioned seabed explorations and stuff like that. So is that something that you also experience in your work in the commission, that there is an increasing reluctance of sharing data for security reasons?
Yeah, certainly we're hearing that point made more frequently, and I have every understanding. I mean, we have 152 member states. They're not only concerned with the ocean environment or ocean industries, they're also concerned and primarily concerned often with national security. That's the role of a government. So clearly, there will be data that for security reasons will not be shared. What we're arguing is that there's also data that is not shared essentially for leniency or for people thinking, oh, it's better to be on the safe side, so let's not share it. I don't know what my boss will say, let's just not raise it. But I think there are huge amounts of data that can be shared with no risk of compromising national security. Then there's the other issue. If you ask a submarine captain, he or she will say, oh, well, we depend on ocean observing. If you don't measure the salinity of the ocean, that's a risk for a submarine. Navies, in many countries, navies actually run ocean government's ocean coordination because they understand the ocean, they depend on ocean data, and they also understand that in some areas it's good to share ocean data even without compromising their security interests.
Yeah, so you're trying to find the sweet spot there where you can convince people that there is still data available that could be shared but isn't for reasons that have nothing to do with security.
Yeah, and you can, if you go to the seafloor, obviously in certain locations, you'll find physical infrastructure on the seafloor that governments do not want to share. But you can also reduce the granularity of the images. So there are solutions to be had. So we have to be realistic, but part of that realism is also that safety and security is enhanced by more data being available. Not only military security, but also coastal security. We're seeing a changing ocean, which brings more hazards with enormous costs. Mm. And I'm not only talking about extreme weather events that impact coastal infrastructure and cities, but also the need for us to observe and have early warning systems for invasive species, for marine heat waves, for harmful algal blooms, for example, that hugely impact and create billions of dollars in losses for aquaculture and fisheries. These are also safety and security issues in terms of economic security.
Nautical numbers.
Nautical numbers is one of the fixed segments of our show where we ask our guests to bring a number that is pertinent to the topic that we're discussing. So what is your nautical number, Vidar?
Well, since we're into data sharing, I could tell you that in our ocean biodiversity information system, which is the go-to place for information about ocean biodiversity, only 3% of the data comes from the private sector. Half of those 3% come from one single country, simply because they have regulations requiring the private sector to share data. I'm not saying this because it's my home country, but it's Norway because they require oil and gas, for example, to share their biodiversity data. And oil and gas is probably the biggest biodiversity research agency in Norwegian waters.
Wow.
So it's just an example that national regulations matter in terms of sharing data and making them available. And that other half, much of it is taken by the UK that has similar regulation.
Okay. So I take away, first of all, the private sector is contributing very, very little. So there's definitely room for improvement. And that is also maybe a call to action to our listeners who primarily come from the maritime business part of it. Maybe, you know, if we can even marginally improve that rate, that would go a long way. And the other thing is truly fascinating is that 1.5% of all the data comes from Norway, which of course is a small country on global standards. So that's quite amazing. And you say that is simply because there is a transparency law or some law that requires those companies to probably not publish every type of data, but certain types of data they collect.
Yeah. And if you're an oil and gas company, obviously there is data that you don't want to share, but biodiversity data is not compromising your business. So there's a requirement to share that. I'd like to mention one example I just learned about the other day. There's a species in the ocean called Antiopella cristata. It's a sludge. Beautiful, actually, for a sludge. It was discovered in 1841 as a species, but only recently has it been found that it has chemical compounds that effectively kill blood cancer cells while not harming healthy cells. And I mentioned this as an example of the many opportunities held by ocean biodiversity for pharmaceutical industries, for example. These species have evolved over millions and billions of years, and they have, in order to survive, they have developed these chemical compounds that we can now put to use, not only to sustain their life, but also to sustain human life. And I think that's a beautiful story of just how much all that we don't know about the ocean and that we're learning about the ocean can be put to use for human well-being, but also for economic opportunity.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating because it highlights that it's not just about the oceans. So basically, data collected from a Norwegian oil rig may, over several steps, cure someone suffering from cancer. There's a lot of steps in between, but I think that's a beautiful connection. So maybe that's also, I hope, I guess, maybe a dream come true for you and your work if more countries would adopt similar requirements to publish data. That would probably enormously raise the amount of information that you could use or the scientific community could use, right?
Yes, and our member states, the assembly of our member states actually adopted at its last assembly a recommendation for member states to put in place regulation that will enable private sector data sharing. That initiative actually came out of that private sector corporate data group that we're having. So it's a demonstration of how the private sector is engaging.
Good to hear that. Now I wanted to talk about something else, which was also the talk of the town in Nice in June of this year, and that is the BBNJ, the new treaty that has now been ratified by enough countries, I understand, so it will come into force. Could you explain what is it about? Why is that such a major game changer for the oceanographic community and all those who push for the protection of the seas?
Well, first, to be realistic, it's not going to be a game changer unless it's properly implemented. But it's, in terms of ocean governance, it's really a game changer because it's an example that even at times that are difficult for the multilateral system and for the UN, we've been able to put in place some significant instruments, and the BBNJ agreement is the last one. It is about managing biodiversity in the high seas. Obviously, within national jurisdictions, that's a national responsibility, but beyond national jurisdiction, it's what is often referred to as the common heritage of humankind. And with more awareness of the importance of those genetic resources, I mentioned that sludge and the pharmaceutical opportunities, for example. With more attention on that, there's also more attention on how we can more fairly and equitably manage and share those resources, including protecting important domains, biodiversity domains, on the high seas. So there's the ambition, just as there's an ambition of protecting 30% of national waters, there's an ambition of protecting 30% of areas beyond national jurisdiction. And then to ensure, I mentioned now the marine genetic resources, I mentioned the protected areas. There's also, the agreement is also about ensuring proper environmental impact assessments ahead of commercial activities. And then, importantly, there's a capacity development and marine technology transfer component of the agreement, which is to ensure more equity and more sharing of opportunities for taking part in the economic uses and the protection activities for the high seas.
You mentioned, of course, that implementation is key. The treaty at the end of the day is at the beginning only a piece of paper.
Yeah, and 10 years after the Paris Agreement, I think it is important to remind ourselves that
absolutely,
the signing of an agreement is just a starting point.
That is true. And unfortunately, as we've also seen, is sometimes we move a step forward and then we move two steps back. So unfortunately, process is also not linear. Now, implementation, how will that work? Because there's of course, there's a plethora of organizations also internationally that play a role there. When it comes to the business side of the oceans, there's the International Maritime Organization. Will they play an important role in the implementation of that treaty? And how will it work with those marine protected areas? Because, of course, there is also some concern on the business side when it comes to shipping lines, etc., that will affect the routes that ships can take because, you know, maybe there will be these protected areas being set up. How will that work in practical terms as far as you see it?
Just to start at that end, the IMO has certainly been actively involved in the negotiation process and are still much involved, not least because that issue you mentioned is a key one. It is important to ensure freedom of navigation, but it is also important to protect rich biodiversity on the high seas. So exactly how this will work out is still to be determined. The agreement will enter into force in January. There are preparatory committees going on a regular basis. A secretariat will be established. It's only the first meeting of the Conference of Parties that will determine where that secretariat will be. So a lot of practicalities to be done. And then alongside those practicalities, discussions on how things will work in practice. And obviously, when it comes to establishing protected areas, you'll need data to know which areas are worthwhile protecting. Once that is done, you need to put in place regulations that will take into account current or potential economic activities. And on the high seas, shipping is obviously the most pertinent. I think based on the data that exists for any protected area, you will have to put in place regulations that protect the biodiversity to the extent possible and then manage the relationship to international shipping. But I think that has to be a concrete discussion for each of the areas. But it's not for me to judge, but that's a process that is and a discussion that will be not solved once and for all, I think.
I guess so. And again, I mean, I understand that, of course, you also have an important role and you have to be impartial in that respect. But I mean, we've recently seen especially at the IMO, since we're talking about that now, that processes can also be derailed. I mean, IMO had and still has the goal for the shipping industry to be climate neutral by 2050. And in principle, at least, we all thought that next year there would be an emission trading scheme put into place. And that process has essentially been derailed. We all know that. That was in the media. Now, how likely do you think that something similar will happen when it comes to setting up these things now with the BBNJ treaty?
Well, I think what we're seeing in a number of areas, derailment and delays and pushback against action. But I think ultimately market dynamics and technological dynamics are leading us, and they're very real needs because we have a planetary system that is changing and creating uncertainty. The fundamental dynamics are still there, and political maneuvering is short term in that perspective. So I think we, much as with the Paris Agreement, there will be ups and downs also for the BBNJ. I'm quite confident about that. But the direction has been set, and then member states will have the responsibility of taking that agenda forward and taking the actions needed to meet the ambitions of the agreement.
That's interesting. Also, what I found when we are talking about the emission trading system now, the IMO, is that often people think that, well, the pushback comes from the industry. But that is not the case, actually. As far as that is concerned, definitely German shipping industry, but I think that's also true for at least the Europeans as a whole and for many other countries as well. They were actually quite in favor. So they've been saying, well, the only thing we want is, well, it's two things. First of all, we want a level playing field. So we want global regulation systems, so not just the European system, but something that actually applies to all players around the world so that no one has an unfair advantage. And we want a system that is relatively straightforward and easy to handle. So not 25 different systems or frameworks that we have to comply with. But if those conditions are required, we're actually accepting that we have to contribute and we have to change and we have to become carbon neutral. So sometimes it's not business or lobbyists that try to derail process, but it's pure politics, I guess, or maybe players from other sectors, of course.
Yeah, you're pointing to something very important. I believe that the private sector is critical, not only because they create jobs and economic opportunity, but they're critical in this context because they understand risk. I've been a politician, and I must admit that risk calculations in politics are very different from risk calculations when you talk about nature or when you talk about industry. And clearly, if you're a maritime industry, you don't want more shocking weather events that can derail passage or destroy ports. If you're in aquaculture, you don't want more sudden harmful algal blooms activities. If you're in ocean tourism, you also don't want stinking algal blooms, sargassum or whatever, and you don't want flooding in coastal tourist territories. If you're in finance, you see these risks very clearly. If you're in insurance, you see this risk is already happening. So I think industries are facing more risks coming from these fundamental changes to our planetary system. And many of those changes are driven from and start in the ocean, given the ocean's enormity and therefore importance for the planetary system. So I really see great hope in what is rather a massive movement in industries in the right direction, driven also by technological progress and science progress, and that will sustain political setbacks. I'm not saying that movement on the part of industry goes fast enough, and obviously industries also depend on framework conditions set by political authorities, but fundamentally things are moving in the right direction, they're just not moving fast enough.
Navigators, table.
That is another fixed segment that we have in our podcast. And we always ask for good recommendations for a restaurant, a bar, something that has to do with the oceans. What would be your recommendation, Vidar?
Yeah, I don't know if it still exists, but my possibly best seafood meal ever, I had in a shack on the southernmost tip of Africa in a town called Arniston in South Africa. Really, really a shack in an old fisherman's village. You had to bring your own wine. So we got that from the hotel and then we visited this restaurant, my wife and I, because it was recommended. And we sat down a bit skeptical and in comes the most delicious and the most fresh catch you could ever imagine. And I think that's telling of the richness of the ocean and the opportunities of the ocean, that in different conditions, in very different levels of economic development and levels of technology and levels of infrastructure, the ocean can produce miracles and livelihoods and great moments.
Excellent. We'll try to find a link, maybe not to the shack itself, because I somehow doubt that it will have its own website, but to the location. So that whenever people go to South Africa, they can find out for themselves. Thank you very much for this recommendation, Vidar. I wanted to talk about something that you mentioned earlier, because I find that quite interesting, and that is the digital twin of the ocean. And of course, digital twins, you meet them quite often nowadays. I've seen digital twins of cruise ships that were presented to me. I know that ports, I was in Singapore earlier this year, they are building a digital twin of their entire new port. So it's quite the rage, one could say, to have a digital twin of whatever you're working on. Now, of course, the oceans is a different animal, so to speak. How can I imagine that to come to fruition? What will that entail?
Well, there's a major EU project for a digital twin of the ocean. It's going to be very important for visualizing and predicting ocean events. But when it comes to the ocean, there's the additional element that we don't live there. It's extremely important for us as human beings, but we don't really realize it. There's no media there. There's no political party or a newspaper or economic pressure groups or civil society. So visualizing, understanding the ocean is quite difficult. Just recently, this new Attenborough movie about the ocean brought some footage, I think for the first time, of bottom trawling. Now, we've been used to seeing bulldozers in the Amazonas, but this is the first time we've seen images of what actually takes place in the ocean. But given that there aren't cameras running in the ocean at all times. I think the digital twins can really be key in building better awareness of what the ocean entails, what actually exists there, the fantastic opportunities and the fantastic richness and its importance for human life on land as well. So I think there are scientific uses, there are prediction and observation uses, there are economic uses of this, but there's also the very human relationship to the ocean, the importance of it.
Yeah, that is interesting that you mention it as a tool for public awareness or public outreach. And I think you're right, because on the one hand, the oceans have a very good image. If you go out on the street and you ask random people, are you in favor of protecting the oceans? You would probably having a hard time finding someone who would say, no, I don't care. But then again, because we don't see it, or the part that we see is only the surface, often only, you know, the coast of it, unless we're on a ship ourselves, is that we sometimes don't realize what's at stake.
Yeah. And if you ask that person a follow-up question on what's the biggest concern about the ocean, I guess 9 out of 10 would say plastic pollution. And clearly, plastic pollution is a big issue, but it's not the only one. There's nutrient pollution, runoff from agriculture, from chemical industries, from household waste. That's on the pollution side. There's climate change fundamentally altering the ocean. There's biodiversity loss. There's overfishing. I mean, there's such an array of issues. And much of that is not seen and therefore not known. So I'm not against people being aware of the plastics issue, but it's one out of an array of critical issues facing the ocean.
Yeah. But maybe it also has to do with the power of the images, because you've ever seen a photo or a video of these huge, sometimes, I don't know how big they are, but these floating islands of plastic garbage, that is quite a powerful image. And maybe other issues, they don't lend themselves to the sludge or the algae. It's not that powerful visually.
No, absolutely. And it's also a fact that we surround ourselves with plastics in our daily lives. So we can relate to it.
Right.
We see it on beaches or in rivers, but we don't think so much when we consume agricultural produce. We don't think so much about the nutrients that go into producing them. So I think we need to broaden our understanding of the ocean blessings and the ocean hazards.
Now, we talked about balancing, of course, economic needs with the needs for protecting the oceans. But sometimes it even goes further, because, you know, you mentioned climate change, of course, and climate change also has an impact on the seas, rising sea levels, etc. So we need to solve that issue as well. And I understand there can also be sometimes quite direct competition between those goals. Just one example, of course, we need to decarbonize. To decarbonize, we need renewables. Now, in Germany, also in Norway, offshore wind is an important issue, which, again, you know, if you talk to some environmentalists, they're not too happy about all those wind parks popping up in the North Sea. Is that something that you're also working on? And can you quantify? Is that a price worth paying? So we lose a little bit of biodiversity by setting up a new wind park, but we gain so much by, you know, avoiding so and so many tons of fossil fuels? Or is that difficult to make those calculations?
First of all, it's totally clear that we need more renewable energy. It's not realistic to think that we don't need more renewable energy. And secondly, the opportunities from the ocean for renewable energy are enormous. Next from there, we're back to data. We're back to planning. We're back to the dull stuff of really getting the data we need to ensure, and the consultation processes we need, so that trade-offs, if there are trade-offs, are done in a transparent way, in a democratic way, so that we can assess upsides and downsides. But if we do that, the ocean territories are in most places so vast that there will be opportunities for combining energy, food, maritime routes, etc.
So everything is connected. I mean, I guess that's also a trivial comment to say, but it's nevertheless true, particularly in the oceans. Absolutely fascinating. And we talked about this before our conversation here, is that I'm still new in the world of oceans and maritime business. But one of the things that people told me at the beginning is once you enter the area, you never really leave. And I guess looking at your CV, that's also true for you. And even if you left, it was just temporarily. You were always drawn back to the oceans. Sooner or later.
Absolutely. There's an endlessness of mysteries and lessons to be had from the ocean. That's part of the beauty.
Thank you very much for being available for this conversation. It was very interesting for me, and I'm also sure for our listeners who've learned a lot about the important work that you do, but also about the facts about the ocean, and more particularly about the things that we don't know yet about the ocean. So best of luck with the next endeavors. I would love to chat with you again at some point to see where the BBNJ treaty went. Also, maybe what comes after the UN Ocean decade, because I think it's fair enough to assume that we will not have solved every issue before the decade comes to an end. So there will have to be something afterwards. Thank you very much. I look forward to continuing this conversation.
Thank you, and likewise. And I hope we'll meet before the next UN Ocean conference.
That will be great. Thank you for listening to this episode. I hope you learned something new. If you like the show, please leave us a review and a rating on your favorite podcasting platform. And don't forget to check out the show notes and more information about the German Maritime Center at maritimematters.de.